Good morning, this is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the June 8, 2022 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being conducted telephonically to provide further access by the public. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staffs, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask the participating staff to please mute your telephones if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, please call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. Corinne Myers, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide additional information on this.
Good morning, this is Corinne Myers. Members of the public can visit the RA Housing website to view today's agenda and information on the actions taken. If the teleconference portion is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please state your name prior to speaking. And with that reminder, I'll turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Great, thank you, Corinne. I would call the meeting to order today. And do you need to do a...
I do need to do a roll call.
Okay,
roll call. Yeah, yes. Commissioner Liz Tanner,
here.
Commissioner Kevin Orth,
here.
You have a quorum.
Great, thank you, Carol. Let's. We have a very long agenda. This is very exciting to see. I think we'll try to keep it moving along, but also try to give each project its due. So, first thing is the approval of minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on May 11th, 2022. Have a motion.
So moved.
I'll second it. Corinne, Lisa, Coastal.
Certainly. This is Corinne speaking. If you're in favor of recommending approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on May 11th, 2022, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes appear to have it with 2 affirmative votes.
Great. Thank you very much. Anne, will you be presenting each of the...
But Ian can introduce the member app.
So we'll go to agenda item number 2, recommendation for firm approval financing for Copley Chambers 1 located in Providence.
Thanks, Kevin. Caroline Guyline will make this presentation.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Caroline Guyline. This project is Copley Chambers 1. It's a vertically integrated project with Marathon Development as the developer and Marathon Construction as the general contractor. This request is for firm commitment of a taxable construction loan totaling $3 million, of which $2,310,000 will remain as a permanent bridge mortgage. The total development cost is approximately $6.6 million, or $265,000 per dwelling unit. The project involves the rehab of a vacant historic building located at 206 Broad Street in Providence. The building is on the National Register of Historic Places. The developer will convert the structure into a mixed-use building with 26 affordable units and first floor commercial space to be occupied by supportive service providers. Of the 26 units, 8 will be supported by project-based vouchers from the Providence Housing Authority. The project received preliminary approval from Rhode Island Housing in April. The project conforms to Rhode Island Housing underwriting standards with the exception of failing the second bridge loan test. The borrower will execute a recourse guarantee for the loan and the guarantee for construction completion. Happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you very much. I have a motion to approve firm approval of financing for Copley Chambers 1.
So moved.
I'll second that. Great. Do you have any questions about
it? Well, I think it's really interesting that it's one of the first apartment buildings in the city. I thought that was pretty neat. But I always want to ask about the medium risk for Marathon. It looks like I just want to have do they not have a lot of history here?
But this is their first deal with us and their first venture into affordable housing. And that's why they have a medium risk, but they have a large portfolio of other commercial deals throughout New England.
We've also partnered with them on the Rockville Mill,
yes,
up in Hopkinton through the, I think it was CARES
Act. It was the CARES Act acquisition,
yes,
program that we ran a couple of years,
yes,
ago.
Yes,
yep,
yes. And
14 units.
The property is operating well.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'll have a follow-up question to that. In terms of mitigating the risk, since they failed the second test of the bridge loan, you're requiring them to have personal guarantees. Do you feel like they could come through with those if they're called upon?
No doubt.
Okay, great. I also note that the appraisal, the difference in the underwriting versus the appraisal is maybe about 10%. I think it was maybe, I don't know, 85 loan of value versus 97 or something along like that. Is that, which I think is fine, but do you feel like the appraisal is reasonable and can be relied upon?
I do think the appraisal is reasonable. I think we're being more conservative than the appraiser was. But the rents are supported, their comps that the appraiser used were good. I think it supports.
Okay, great, thank you. I have no other questions. Okay, so great. Corinne, would you please take a vote?
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of financing for Copley Chambers 1 in Providence, please say aye.
Aye.
Two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thank you. We'll now move on to item number 3, which is recommendation for firm approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for Bourne Mill 3, located in Everton.
Seth St. Jean will make this presentation.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Seth St. Jean. So the project is Bourne Mill 3, and the developer is the Armory Revival Company. The request is for firm commitment of a taxable permanent loan totaling $4.375 million, and reservation of up to $1,298,500 of 2021 or 2022 LIHTC credits. The project previously received preliminary commitment back in May of 2021. Proposed Bourne Mill 3 is located in Tiverton and will be a new 59-unit mixed-income development. There will be a mix of efficiency, 1- and 2-bedroom units. 47 of them will be 60% AMI, and 12 will be market rate. Current total development cost is approximately $22.2 million, which equates to roughly $376,000 per unit. Cost between preliminary and BURP has risen roughly $5 million. Increases were predominantly due to construction cost escalations, as you know, many have seen throughout the industry. Also, since preliminary, there is a solar component that was added and other energy efficiencies added to the scope of work. The developer undertook extensive value engineering with GC SAM to help lower costs. A portion of the increase will be funded by additional deferred developer fee and a seller loan related to the acquisition costs. The project previously received $2.79 million in DHRI funding, and syndicator is RBC is projecting 9.5 cents per credit. The project conforms to Rhode Island Housing underwriting standards, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you, Seth. Can I have a motion to recommend firm approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for Bourne Mill 3?
So moved.
And seconded. Great. Do you have any questions about this?
I do not.
Okay. But I'll toss one out. So the construction cost is, or the total development cost, as you say, went up about 30%, about $5 million. Is that, you say that's fair to say that's construction cost or solely?
Yeah, I would say probably, you know, 80% of that is construction cost.
Okay. And what I think that this might, and this doesn't really just apply to this deal, but I see that Millray is kind of a similar place. What I know you probably had some discussion about, what do we do given the big increase in construction costs out there? How do we don't want to hit the developers on the head too hard. We want to see these deals go through, but presumably we want to hold their feet to the fire a bit. So what, how do you arrive at some kind of policy, I guess?
You know, that's a great question. And to a certain extent, some of these are, it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. And in this particular case, the developer did a lot of value engineering. They're also deferring significantly more fee than they started and a seller loan. So collectively, they're bringing $600,000 to the table. I know that we're spending a lot of time working with developers and their contractors to value engineer. But the truth is, we're seeing We just had this conversation yesterday afternoon. A lot of change orders related to projects that are under construction and sort of how to deal with those change orders. And, you know, the contingencies, we're trying to push contingencies to 10%. I know that the in this particular case, there's been some conversation between the bar, a lot of conversations between the borrower and the general contractor about how to, you know, pivot and substitute when necessary. And I think, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, and I think it's really hard for us to, at least at this point in time, come up with a set policy that says you have to do X, Y, or Z.
We're trying to
thread that needle.
And I think, too, in addition to some of the external things that we can't control, the supply chain, material scarcity, fuel costs, things like that, we're looking at, pardon me, what's within our control as part of our process. So we are going to be having an internal meeting with our design and construction team and our development team to see if there are some things that we think we can do to kind of slim down our approach, and also meet with some general contractors in a group and say, what are you seeing out there? What can we do? How can we work better together to kind of ease some of the administrative costs or make the process go a little bit smoother? So hopefully we'll receive some.
So unpredictable right now, even for seasoned contractors, and there is a seasoned contractor on this particular project, and Omri certainly has done development.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's challenging times, as you know, right?
Yes. Yeah. Even if it's a related GC.
Yeah.
Going through that now. Okay. I didn't really have any other questions about this one myself. Corinne, let's take a look.
This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of a reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for Bourne Mill 3 in Tiverton, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the ayes have it.
Okay, thank you. I will now move on to item number 4, which is recommendation for firm approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for the Millrace District project located in Woonsocket.
Thanks, and Jeff Swanson is going to make that presentation.
This is Jeff Swanson. Good morning, Commissioners. And I apologize as I was making my way to the table. I guess try to read Hill Race or Bear Hill first.
Sorry.
So we kind of just touched on Mill Race a moment ago, but this is firm approval for a 9% LIHTC project. It originally received approval in May, preliminary approval in May 2021. This is a mill conversion in Cumberland. Today we are before you requesting approval of 9% tax credits of $1,117,210, home program funds of $2 million, housing trust funds of $1,745,430, and capital magnet funds of $100,000. This project represents three vacant and contaminated mill buildings, which will be rehabbed into 70 affordable residential units with approximately 24,000 square feet of commercial space on the first floor. Because this project has received a federal home loan bank award, Rhode Island Housing will not be either the construction nor the permanent lender, which is a little unusual for us. Some substantial changes since this project received preliminary approval is that rather than creating commercial and residential condominium units, the developers decided to master lease the commercial space, which we believe is a simpler and better ownership structure. The overall TDC has increased 3.85 million, which represents almost 14% increase since preliminary. But we note the developer is able to bring approximately $1.4 million to the project in the form of increased tax credit and historic credit equity. So they've increased their pricing, and in the case of the historic, because of the higher cost, there's greater amounts of federal credits generated. And then also, based on the advice from tax counsel as we work towards the closing, the application of the commercial and residential components has changed, with a greater percentage of the costs allocated to the residential project. So I'll leave it there. Answer any questions?
Thank you, Jeff. May I have a motion to recommend firm approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for the Mill Race District?
So moved.
And I'll second it. Do you have any questions?
No.
Okay, great. I think we kind of covered the cost increase issue on the Bourne Mill project. And this one, as you mentioned, Jeff, the Citizens Bank is doing both the construction and the perm loan, so I think our risk in this very complex deal is relatively low, and it'd be great to see it up and running. So I don't have any questions either. So,
this is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of a reservation of low-income housing tax credits and financing for the Mill Race District in Woonsocket, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion's approved.
Great, thank you, Corinne. I'd like to recognize our Secretary of Commerce, Stephen Pryor, and also Hannah, thank you for attending our meeting today. Very happy to see you. We have a super long agenda, and I know you two are incredibly busy, so what I'd like to do is move our order around a little bit so we can discuss item number 10, which is the Acquisition Revitalization Program funding.
So James will make a brief presentation and turn it over to the Secretary to make his comments.
Certainly. Great. James.
Nice to be the opening act here. So this morning, this is James Comer. This is a recommendation for an award under the Acquisition and Revitalization Program to High Rock Development for the development of 111 Westminster Street, commonly known as the Superman Building. The ARP program is part of the $65 million bond approved by the voters in March of 2021, of which $15 million was set aside for the ARP program. Rhode Island Housing has been designated by Rhode Island Commerce Corporation to administer this program. There's about $10 million remaining in the program. ARP's purpose is to stabilize neighborhoods and communities by strategically targeting foreclosed and or blighted residential and commercial properties and vacant lots in need of redevelopment. This will revitalize neighborhoods and communities, stabilize the housing market, and improve local economies. Rhode Island Housing issued a request for proposals for ARP funds in November and received 17 proposals. These proposals were reviewed with staff, and an external advisory committee was convened to also review the proposals in February. As part of that review, the 111 Westminster project was tentatively approved for funding, pending the developer securing additional financing. Since that time, the developer has secured commitments from Rhode Island Commerce Corporation and the City of Providence, and therefore we're comfortable moving forward at this time with the recommendation for $1 million of ARP funding. High Rock is redeveloping 111 Westminster into a residential building with 285 units, of which 59 will be earmarked for households earning between 80 and 120%. The ARP fund specifically will be earmarked for the 26,000 square foot first floor atrium space, which will be a public facility as defined in the ARP guidelines. This community space will be available to community groups and organizations interested in community-oriented program. This award is contingent upon completion of the entire capital stack and financial closing on both the construction and permanent loans. Happy to answer any questions. I'll turn it over to Secretary Pryor, and you can
appreciate that.
Jump in.
Outstanding summary. I want to note this is actually one of my last public meetings as Commerce Secretary. The next few days I'll be transitioning, and it's really an honor to be in front of you. I want to thank this group and the broader Rhode Island Housing Board and Rhode Island Housing stakeholders for your amazing work over these seven and a half years of our collaboration together. I want to recognize Carol for really doing an exemplary job, and some terrific board members. I'm biased, but the DDR director, in addition to doing a great job there, and as a Commerce team member, is a valued partner through all this. I happen to have been in the room with then Speaker Mattiello when we negotiated the ARP program and talked about the importance of enabling Rhode Island Housing under leaders like Carol on this board. Kevin has been absolutely a terrific board member, and thank you for your partnership, Kevin. To enable this board to engage with the issue of blight, underutilization, dormant buildings, dormant parcels, pleased to see that over generations of legislative leadership, it has occurred and remained, and that you all have put it to good use. And I have to say, in my view, having been privy to those conversations, this is perhaps the optimal use of that program. There is no more visible dormant structure, dark structure, that ought to be brought back to life in the Superman building. Certainly there are other extraordinarily important uses of the program where there'll be contributory going forward positive uses, don't get me wrong, but as a symbol, in addition to the practical purposes, this one really matters. Well, thank you for even taking it up. And I can tell you there were some very complex and hard bargaining-oriented negotiations that led up to this full capital stack materializing. But as James has ably expressed, we're very pleased that we not only framed a deal, it took 7 months of nearly daily negotiations. Thanks to Carol that on the components that matter to Rhode Island Housing, we were able to consult with Carol for her expertise. And as you know, we're asking Rhode Island Housing to do a couple of components. Altogether, the state's contribution is only 12% of project costs. You may know that under even just our commerce tool, the Rebuild Rhode Island Tax Credit Program, we often go to 20% of project costs and sometimes as far as 30%. So we're leveraging a great deal of additional investment. James expressed this, but some of the key public approvals now are already behind us, so you can be confident that the public approvals have great momentum. Rhode Island Commerce Board, unanimous. Province Redevelopment Authority, unanimous. Last night's Senate Finance Committee, unanimous in favor of the extended tax stabilization agreement enabling legislation that will go to the City Council, testifying in favor, by the way, last night, the Council President, Igliozzi, in person, John Igliozzi, who also has ensured that the $5 million that the city needs to have in the budget will be in the budget. You get the feel for it. So all parties are working to enable this to occur. The total set of public investments include that Rebuild Rhode Island tax credit at $15 million, closing fund at 5.7, $4.5 million requested from a separate program here. I know a separate matter not being taken up today. That's your Workforce Housing Innovation Challenge, and this $1 million from the ARP program. So the last thing I want to say is Hannah and I both happened to be, I think Carol was on also this morning, the Providence Foundation Board's meeting.
Yep.
And we were witness to, you all know the Providence Foundation is a good assortment of downtown and broader Providence and even statewide stakeholders. And the feeling is after 9 years of this building being vacant, we really can do it this time. And the reason for the optimism, these public approvals. Another reason for the optimism, the residential market is strong and we need more housing stock in general, more supply to reduce some of the price pressure, and we need more deliberately affordable and workforce units. And this project does those things. So there's a lot more to say, but Kevin, we wanted to be here in person, Mr. Chair, just to enable you to ask questions if you have them, and perhaps equally important to express our enthusiasm and our thanks.
Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your attendance and look forward to asking a few questions here. So let's start off with a motion to recommend approval of acquisition of the Solution Program funding.
So moved.
I will second that. Do you have any questions to lead off?
Not yet.
Okay, great. I echo your comment, Secretary, that there might not be a better use of blight funding than putting it into this structure. I think that it could go a long way to civic improvement, civic pride, and hopefully economic development. And the fact that we're getting a lot of housing units, we certainly like that. I would, and the state from so many different sides is coming together. It's wonderful to see that at this moment. I'd like to ask the staff just to confirm in reviewing to make sure that the threshold criteria has been satisfied, and namely just that the project is financially feasible and that the applicant has demonstrated the experience and capacity to handle this type of project.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We do feel that.
Yes, we do believe that.
I have no other questions myself. Great. Corinne, would you please take the vote?
Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of an acquisition and revitalization program funding award, ARP award, as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, take care. We'll now jump back to item number 5, which is the recommendation for firm approval of financing for Bear Hill Village located in Cumberland.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
And again, Jeff Swanson.
Jeff Swanson.
Yes. Okay, great. Thank you, Jeff.
Yes, this is Jeff Swanson, executive at Bear Hill Village in Cumberland. This is the seventh and final property that has come before you in the last few months that's in the portfolio owned by Providence Realty Investment. This is a fairly straightforward refinance with an equity takeout. We are requesting approval of a new first mortgage not to exceed $22,640,000. The proposed source of funds for that loan will be the FFB program, and we're projecting an equity takeout of approximately $10 million. This is a 126-unit age-restricted property that executed a new one-year contract last fall. Post-closing, the borrower will complete a relatively modest scope of work totaling approximately $350,000. This will primarily consist of elevator upgrades with some roof replacements. And in the past 6 months, management's also completed additional repairs that were deemed critical in the CMA report. To ensure the project is well positioned for future capital needs, the initial deposit to the replacement reserve at closing will be over $7,700 per unit. Our base price for when we begin underwriting is $2,000 per unit, so they're well in excess of that. They will also make annual contributions to the replacement reserve of $400 per unit in our, again, our standard underwriting. The underwriting does conform to Rhode Island Housing's standard requirements, except for the vacancy rate we use. A minimum of 5% vacancy is typical, but given the presence of a HAP contract at this property and the historic vacancy hovering around 1%, we believe an underwriting vacancy rate of 4% is appropriate.
Great. Thank you very much, Jeff. I have a motion to recommend firm approval of financing for Bear Hill Village.
So moved.
And I will second that. Do you have any questions about this?
Well, so not unlike your question about construction costs, I see the interest rate fluctuation piece. I just wanted to ask you, what are your plans to handle that fluctuation?
So in this particular case, it's quite easy. The Federal Financing Bank literally sends us a pricing schedule every day. So when we're ready to rate lock, we can finance the developer. We've already rate locked a couple of his deals, and the developer understands that the rate goes up and the loan goes down. There's plenty of room in this transaction. I think right now we're probably closer to, with our spread, 5.55. Depends what day. I mean, last week they dropped 30 basis points, and then this week they came back up 30 basis points. So it, sometimes it's just, you know, whatever day they go to re-lock.
Yeah, I think we were writing this up 5.35. And now we're between 5.55 and 5.6.
Thank you. I have a follow-up. Kara, could you let us know maybe what the spread between, let's say, this FFB is and our standard taxable loan program? Say the I think Copley would be using that one, if I'm right.
Sure. So, you know, we try to achieve a full spread as if we were in the tax-exempt market. So in tax-exempt, we're restricted to 150 basis points. So that would be our goal. It doesn't always happen, and, you know, depending on the day of the rate lock, there's a couple of days of interest rate risk. So we would attempt to get the 150 basis points as well as the fee for risk share that they have to pay.
Which is?
12.5 basis points.
12.5, okay. So we're looking at a base index rate in the high threes for this? Okay. And so there's, I would have thought there would have been much greater spread on the FFB in our normal taxable program, but it looks like it's less than 50 basis points?
Well, it is, right now it's probably less than just 50 basis points. I think the, you know, depending on the curve, if they're doing a 17-year balloon in,
right,
you know, in connection with a 40-year amortization, that would,
right,
make a difference.
Okay.
But that, yeah, the spread has shrunk.
Okay. And if someone is going out to do a 223F, which I assume might be a competitor to the FFB, that's as I'm seeing recently, it's about 115 basis points over the 10-year. So maybe it's at like a 415 plus your servicing fee, or it may be 445, 450. So it's about a full point under.
It is.
Is that?
That is accurate. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
This developer, we spent a long time working with this developer. They have seven deals. The prepayment fee for those seven deals was extraordinary. We've been worked really hard with them, and I think we're all at a place where this deal makes economic sense for them.
Right. Okay. So it's the business relationship and the willingness to be flexible and the prepayment penalty, and also probably the speed. I mean, to do it right now.
Yes. Much faster.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's great that we can keep it in-house. I don't have any other questions. Corinne, would you please take a vote for us?
Yes. This is Corinne Myers speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of financing for Bear Hill Village in Cumberland, please say aye.
Aye.
Two affirmative votes. The motion is approved.
Great. Thank you. We'll now move on to agenda item six, which is recommendation for approval of prepayment for Mount Vernon Temple North apartments located in Woonsocket.
Yep, and Dean Harrison will make this presentation.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dean.
Good morning, everyone. Dean Harrison. This RFA is an administrative action required under the general rules governing multifamily loans. Mount Vernon Temple North apartments request for action is approval of the prepayment of the existing first mortgage in Junior Road of Mount Vernon Temple North Apartments located in Woonsocket. The owner of the development is Mount Vernon Temple Associates in his partnership. The development was refinanced in 2005 utilizing LIHTC in financing from Rhode Island Housing. The initial LIHTC compliance is completed. The development consists of two properties for a total of 123 apartments for elderly and disabled households. All units have project phase section 8. Temple North is a 24-unit development consisting of 12 one-bedrooms and 12 two-bedroom units. Mount Vernon, approximately 2 miles away, consists of 99 units, which are 49 studios and 51 bedrooms. The limited partner is forcing the sale of the properties to maximize their return. The property is currently being marketed for sale. They do not have a buyer at this point. Since the identity of the purchase of the development is unknown, a condition of the prepayment is that the purchaser and the property management company be acceptable to Rhode Island Housing in all respects, as Rhode Island Housing contains both the regulatory agreement and the LIHTC use agreement on the development. It should be noted that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development will need to approve any new owner and management company as part of the assignment of the HAP contract. So we ask approval of the following: that Mount Vernon Temple North Apartment Associates Limited Partnership prepayment of the first mortgage and junior loan on Mount Vernon Temple North Apartments.
Great. Thanks so much.
Is there any questions?
Take a motion for the approval of prepayment for Mount Vernon Temple North Apartments, please.
So moved.
Second. Any questions on this one, Liz?
No, thank you.
Okay. I don't have any either. It seems to be a straightforward transaction, other than the fact that you don't know who the buyer is yet.
But yes. It's really administrative at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of prepayment for Mount Vernon Temple North Apartments in Woonsocket, please say aye.
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 With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thanks, Corinne. Let's move on to item number seven, which is recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets for Hillcrest Village Apartments located in Providence.
Thank you. Dean Harrison will present this and the next three, which are all practically identical except for the property itself.
Okay.
Once again, these next three requests for action are administrative action required under a general rules governing multifamily loan programs. The request for action is for approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest in the three properties, which is Hillcrest Village, Hillside Village and Pocasset Manor, all are affordable housing developments for elderly and disabled households located in Providence. All three developments' initial 15-year compliance periods ended in 2021. The transfer allowed the transferee to buy out the limited partners now that the initial compliance period has ended. All three general partners and transferees of the developments are affiliates of Preservation of Affordable Housing, also known as POA. No new financing currently anticipated for these developments. The transferee will assume all obligations that are currently encumbering the developments. The current property owner, property managers for the developments are POA Communities LLC. The owner and the management companies are affiliated entities. We anticipate no changes in the management agent is contemplated at this time. The developments have received REACT scores of 93B, 98B, and 97B, respectively, on its most recent REACT. And POA has provided a list of capital improvements made over the past few years. So we're asking for approval for, and I can read off, I'm going to read off each one separately. First one is Preservation of Affordable Housing, Inc., approval of the transfer of the limited partnership in Hillcrest Preservation Associates Limited Partnership, the owner of Hillcrest Apartments, from PNC Multifamily Capital Institutional Fund 31 Limited Partnership and Columbia Housing Special Limited Partner Corporation to the Preservation of Affordable Housing, Inc., Affordable Housing LLC. The second one is the Preservation of Affordable Housing, Inc. approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest in Hillside Preservation Associates Limited Partnership, the owner of Hillside Village Apartments, from PNC Multifamily Capital Institutional Fund 31 Limited Partnership and Columbia Housing Special Limited Partner Corporations to Preservation of Affordable Housing, LLC. And the third is the Preservation of Affordable Housing, Inc., approval of the transfer of the limited partnership interest in Pocasset Preservation Associates Limited Partnership, the owner of the Pocasset Manor Apartments, from PNC Multifamily Capital Institutional Fund 31 Limited Partnership in Columbia Housing Special Limited Partnership Corporation to Preservation of Affordable Housing, LLC. Happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Thank you. I assume we need to take these one by one.
Yes, please.
Okay. Let's see, so may I have a motion to approve the transfer of physical assets for Hillcrest Village Apartments?
So moved.
I will second that. Any comments or questions about this one?
I was just curious what our processing fee for is for this.
$1,500.
I don't have, this is, the property's in very good condition. It's going to a seasoned GP. It's a very administrative action.
Yes.
Okay, I don't have any questions. Can we take a vote, please?
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you are in favor of recommending approval of a transfer of physical assets, or TPA, for Hillcrest Village Apartments in Providence as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great, thank you, and we'll move on to item 8, which is recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets for Hillside Village Apartments. Take your presentation, I guess, you did previously. It's the same for this one. Well, I'll take a motion, please.
So moved.
And I'll second it. And we have a vote, please.
Certainly. This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of a transfer of physical assets, or TPA, for Hillside Village Apartments in Providence as presented, please say aye.
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 With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great. And agenda item number 9, recommendation for approval of transfer of physical assets for Pocasset Manor Apartments in Providence. So item just described. I have a motion for this one, please. And I will second. Corey?
Yes, this is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of a transfer of physical assets, or TPA, for Pocasset Manor Apartments in Providence as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great, thank you. And so we'll skip down to item number 11, which is recommendation for approval of Rhode Island Rebound's Production Fund Program Funding Awards, the RIRPF.
I just want to mention that for both this action and for the approval of the Housing Production Fund, we are still negotiating an MOU with the state. So if we're not successful in securing those two MOUs, then we won't be bringing to the full board. We'll hold it until August until we can all agree on the terms of administration of that program.
Okay.
All right. But great. Fine to come to you today for your review and evaluation of the program.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you. This is Ann Berman. I'll be presenting this. And I just want to say a quick thank you to staff, both the multifamily staff that's here now and the what we call our ancillary ancillary group. They did a yeoman's job. We talked about this before, 53 applications seeking $217 million, and basically we reviewed them in 5 weeks. And it was quite the lift, so I just want to say thank you to everybody.
Terrific job.
The Rhode Island Rebounds Production Fund is funded through state and local fiscal recovery funds appropriated through Treasury ARPA dollars from the American Rescue Plan Act that came to the state. And it is designated for production of affordable housing for households with incomes at or below 80% of area median income. The initial allocation to us was $15 million. In March of 2022, as we mentioned, we issued a request for proposals and received many applications. We were oversubscribed 4-1. In those applications, approximately $33 million of the requests were for rebounds funding. The threshold criteria, we have four threshold criteria, which are consistent across the bulk of our funding sources: developer capacity, financial feasibility, readiness to proceed, and marketability. We are recommending 13 projects today for a total of $14.75 million of rebounds commitments. Each of the commitments is subject to our standard underwriting and completion of the full capital stack. I will note that collectively this funding will create 550 new units of housing, of which 486 are for households below 80% of area median income, and 168 will serve households below 30% of AMI. There are 64 units in these developments here that will be for residents above 80%, and in some cases below 120, and in some cases market rate. So I will quickly run through the 13 projects. I will be brief. The first is West House in Middletown, 54 units of 55-plus housing. We're recommending $1 million of rebounds. This is a 9% transaction that previously received preliminary commitment. Summer Street in Providence, this is a twinning deal that has previously received approval. This is for the 9% tranche. It is a $2.5 million rebounds award. Frenchtown, 9% and 4%, located in East Greenwich, also a twinning deal, also previously received approval of the 9% tax credits. This rebounds award is for $1 million for the 9% and $757,000 for the 4%. I will note, and we've talked about this before, that rebounds ARPA dollars in general are difficult to use with tax credits, just because of the way that Treasury is interpreting the regulations. So the awards for the tax credit deals are relatively small. The fourth one is Villages at Manville, which is located in Lincoln, also has a preliminary approval of 9% tax credits, 72 units, 54 are affordable. The rebounds award is for $305,670. Bourne Mill 3 in Tiverton, which we've previously discussed, 59 units. With the approval of this $1.6 million rebounds award, Bourne Mill will be able to move to construction closing, and we hope under construction in the next 90 days. Sutton Place in East Providence is the sixth project. It's 36 units, all below 80% AMI. This project has previously closed, but was challenged by some construction cost increases. It had a pretty narrow budget to begin with. These were code-related issues, so we are recommending approval of $200,000 of rebounds funds. Mill race in Woonsocket, we've mentioned that previously. This is for a commitment of $1,419,000 in rebounds money. And again, this will is the last in the capital stack, will allow the project to move to closing. Riverside Landing in Coventry, 8 units. This is a project that has been kicking around Rhode Island Housing for
15 years.
I was going to say a real time. I was going to say 10, but, you know. There's 8 units restricted to 50% AMI, $374,750 of rebounds. The ninth project is looking upwards in Jamestown. I'm particularly excited about this one. It's a demonstration program for providing housing for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's located in Jamestown. This development obviously cannot afford any amortizing debt. This rebounds award is for $3,327,265, and it does complete the capital stack. The 10th is residences at Riverside Square in East Providence, 16 rental units, all below 80%. This rebounds award is for $1,012,441 and also completes the capital stack. Ivy Place in East Providence, 13 affordable units. The rebounds award is for $540,000, and this also completes the capital stack for that project. The last one is Burnin Mill, has preliminary approval of tax-exempt financing, 60 units in Woonsocket, and this is a $500,000 rebounds recommendation. I'm happy to answer any questions, but collectively we're recommending 13 projects seeking $14.75 million for rebounds approval.
Thank you very much, Anne. May I have a motion to recommend approval of Rhode Island Rebounds Production Fund Program?
So moved.
I will second that. Any questions on this?
Well, just to say, I sat here making a list of each of the communities going through, and I was like, that's a pretty diverse geography. So
yeah, we're pretty pleased with that.
Yes.
Yeah. Very especially good. Someone out of Jamestown, that's got to be pretty
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
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 I noticed that a number of the awards are to projects that have been previously funded. So is that, again, the conversation of cost increases and how are we going to be flexible and handle that. But is this an appropriate use of this new set of resources?
Yeah. I believe.
Yeah. We all believe.
Yes.
Right.
And I believe if you asked our Deputy Secretary of Housing, he would say the same thing. That's
right.
An appropriate use of these resources. And it takes some skill weaving these resources, as Ian mentioned, into the tax credit deals in order to, it demonstrates, I think, to the Assembly that there is an important use for these resources, and we need to continue to provide funding for affordable housing.
And I will just note that not all of these are related to cost increases. Some of these were just part of the capital stack. A lot of these applications had previously applied for home and HTF, but we were oversubscribed for HTF 5-1. Mm-hmm. So these are just other sources of financing that thankfully have come to us so we can really move this pipeline along. I think this is really going to clear out our pipeline, and it opens up kind of the runway for the next generation of projects that are going to come to us for funding mm-hmm. in the fall.
Great. Just one other question. So there were 52 proposals and 13 made the cut. So just a quick comment maybe on why others.
It's a bit of a checkerboard. So some of the ones that are not getting funded will get HPF. Some will get being recommended for BHRI, a little bit for preservation, a little bit for capital magnet. Mm-hmm. But quite honestly, we were oversubscribed 4-1. So
yeah.
Unfortunately, 70 to 75% of these projects were not recommended for funding, primarily because of the readiness to proceed. They're just a lot of the projects that came in had come in under our 9% round, so they came in as 4% deals. $13, $14, $15 million worth of gap funds. It was it was a really hard decision.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was to move projects,
right?
Right. The fund projects that can move and get shovels in the ground. That,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think in, you know, in the climate we're in now, hopefully tomorrow when the budget drops, we'll see, you know, additional funding coming right behind it. So it was not that the projects that got funded were no's, it was not right now, because we feel like there'll be additional funding coming in a new round, probably in September.
We're glad to do some promotion on this. I mean, this is a really good story.
It is a very good story, yeah. And of course, we have Christine here and she's on it.
I don't have any other questions. Okay, great. Corinne?
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of RI Rebound's Production Fund Program funding awards as presented, conditional upon execution of the final memorandum of understanding with the applicable funding agency, please say aye.
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 With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thank you. Are zooming along here. Let's go to number agenda item number 12, which is recommendation for approval of Housing Production Fund, HPF, funding awards.
Thank you. This is Ann Berman. The Housing Production Fund was established by the state for the planning and production of affordable housing, again, for households below 80% of AMI. It will be funded by the real estate transfer tax, but was initially seeded by the legislature last year with $25 million. $10 million was earmarked for production, and it was part of the previously mentioned consolidated funding round. Threshold criteria were the same as for the rebounds. We are recommending 7 projects for $10 million. Again, each of the commitments is subject to standard underwriting and the completion of the capital stack. With these 7 awards, we'll create 392 units of housing, some of which we've previously discussed, 360 households below 80%, and 74 will serve households below 30% of AMI. So quickly, we have Frenchtown 4% in East Greenwich, which is one half of the twinning deal that will create 63 units. This HPF award is for $3,626,381, and I apologize for the oddball amounts, but we really were trying hard to spread this money around as well as we could. Bourne Mill 3 in Tiverton, this is the last funding in the capital stack, $177,285. Parcel 9, which is a twinning deal, this is for the 4% tranche. The HPF award is for $676,574, and it is contingent on the simultaneous closing of the 9% piece as well. 50 Washington Square in Newport currently provides 93 units of permanent supportive housing and a homeless shelter, transitional shelter, and some office space for several nonprofits. This has preliminary approval for a refinance. It is undergoing a RAD 2 conversion. The HPF award is for $153,200, which is just part of the capital stack. Park Home 4, this deal has preliminary approval. It's the fourth phase of the redevelopment of the public housing development in Newport's North End. All of the apartments are restricted to households below 60% of AMI. And this HPF award is for $1,576,250. The sixth project is Burnin Mill, which we mentioned previously. This HPF award is for $2,790,000, and I believe pretty much closes their capital stack. The Mill Race is the last project. We're recommending $1,310,000 in HPF awards. So collectively, we are allocating $10 million.
Great. Thank you very much, Anne. May I have a motion to recommend approval of Housing Production Fund funding awards, please?
So moved.
Second, Pat. Any questions or comments?
I guess how many of these are duplicates in that, you know, at first all, we're trying to see
some of them are definitely duplicates. There's probably 4 or 5 across each of these, and then you know, a couple of them got capital magnet, and several of these will also are being recommended for rebounds. I'm sorry, for BHRI. Mm-hmm. Got to work on my acronyms.
And we're slated to bring BHRI to the funding committee next weekend?
June 15th, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And there are
the
more projects beyond the ones that mentioned here that are also getting rebounds funding.
Could you maybe speak to why we would split up, say, you know, give $160,000 of housing production funds and $1.6 million of rebounds instead of just $1.7 million, whatever, one program and funding? I'd imagine it might be just a from a compliance standpoint.
That's part of it. Also, also, you know, there was more rebounds money, but it was harder to use because of the LIHTC issue. So we were trying to literally identify those items that really could be carved out of basis. There were, you know, to the extent that we could limit the number of sources in each project, it certainly makes the closing easier.
I assume you weren't just trying to beat your head against the wall, but I mean,
yes, we do that all the time.
That's alternate.
It was a bit of a checker.
Not back in.
Yeah, like I said, it was a bit of a, you know, an interesting puzzle, and a lot of it had to do with, you know, some projects had more excess spaces than others, and so we could put more rebounds funding into that, and just try to get them all to as many to the finish line as we can, and clear the pipeline for the next group of folks to get funding the next round.
That's great. I seem to recall that Park Home had, is there any issue with a one-to-one replacement deal?
So on that project, prior to coming to us for firm commitment, they need to provide us with a plan for the replacement of the units that are not being done here, which is phase five. And my understanding is they're working on that right now. I would expect probably late fall for that deal for firm commitment.
Okay.
They've really done an extraordinary job across all of their revitalization in that particular area in terms of doing replacement housing, and we partnered with them on placing units in other communities with a voucher program.
See that fifth and final.
Yes.
Let's get through number four first.
This is great. I mean, what a time to be in housing with them.
Yeah.
And coming to all these projects. Fantastic. Vote, please.
Certainly. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of Housing Production Fund or HPF funding awards as presented, conditional upon execution of a final memorandum of understanding with the applicable funding agency, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thank you so much. Now on to our final item, which is recommendation of proposed 2023 qualified allocation.
Right. So here we are again. I feel like we just did this last year. So as you know, the QAP is the guiding document that establishes priorities and policy for allocating both 9% and 4% credits. We update the plan annually in accordance with the requirements of the Treasury Department and the Rhode Island Administrative Procedures Act. I think we all are striving to get to a two-year QAP, but I don't think we're quite there yet. You know, we do use the scoring in the QAP to incentivize our policy goals, so seeking public input in the plan is a key component of the final document. We had a busy spring, but we were able to hold two meetings with stakeholders to discuss some current trends. Certainly, construction pricing was a hot topic, market challenges, community needs, the scoring in general, and sort of the ongoing challenge between sort of urban and non-urban communities. That's a, you know, there's an inherent tension there, as well as sort of the differing community needs for each of those areas. So our proposed QAP, draft QAP, attempts to address many of the stakeholder comments, while also being mindful of our fiduciary responsibility as the allocating agency to address federal requirements and cost containment concerns. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I am going to try and highlight some of them. I will note that a good number of the changes are what I would call non-substantive. We tried really hard to strip out some of the, I would call it commentary, that doesn't really focus on what is required. Kind of clean up the document, make it easier for people to sort of say, you know, here's what the policy is, or here's what the federal guidance is. So you'll see a lot of that. There's a lot of red in this, and that's a lot of it. I would jump down to highlight the first item, which is the addition of a new section on the nonprofit right of first refusal, or ROFR as we call it. The new language codifies and preserves the right of first refusal by qualified non-projects at the end of a compliance period. It's not easy for me to say. Many years ago, I will say that Rhode Island Housing was one of the first housing finance agencies that required all applicants to waive their right to a qualified contract. As you know, there's been a lot of sort of bad actors in the syndication community, so we think that the addition of the ROFR language is another tool for us to ensure that properties remain affordable and, when applicable, in the control of qualified nonprofits. I note that we are also proposing the elimination of the provision of in-person presentation of projects by applicants. This is more of a process item. I think staff would sort of concur, and I think many of the developers would concur as well, that it doesn't add a lot of value. I think we're really pleased with how well applicants have been submitting their applications. They're much more thorough. This year, 10 of 11 passed threshold. So, I mean, they were good quality applications. I think by taking it out, we'll save 3 to 4 weeks in terms of our review. And we'll have to work on a kind of an internal process to make sure that we are reaching out even-handedly to ask questions. And I think, you know, we have a process in place where we seek clarifications. We'll just modify that process to do that. The next thing I will note is, and this is directly to your question around construction costs, we are recommending the elimination of the absolute total development cost cap in the QAP. You know, we know that construction costs are volatile. We know that it's been really sort of unpredictable. And, you know, I think we think that the financial leveraging section in the QAP is 43% of the overall score. That's a big chunk of the scoring criterion, and we think that that is going to help sort of to get to the cost containment without having an absolute cap. The next thing I would note is some modification of the points awarded to high-performing school districts. We are changing that to be a function of high school graduation rates. The metrics related to the graduation rates, quite honestly, are much clearer. They're easier for people to understand, and they are published annually. And we'll provide a link to the Rhode Island Kid Count Factbook, which is where they have some very easy and readable tables in regards to that. We're also going to modify, we're recommending modification of points related to mixed income units. And this is a result of some conversations we had with nonprofits that have expressed concern that some for-profit developers are more likely to undertake mixed income because they're more comfortable with the risk, or they have a stronger balance sheet and can sort of provide those guarantees to syndicators. So we are recommending a slight reduction in points related to that, which we think mitigates some of those concerns. Finally, the last one I would highlight is modified points for broadband. This was a big discussion last year, but sort of The changes are a reflection of the Affordable Connectivity Program, which was included in the infrastructure bill. Under the old scoring criteria, the expectation was there would be no charges to the residents. Well, under this new law, the tenants have to pay something. So basically, we've modified the scoring to sort of reflect that this minimum payment is required from residents. That's it. I think, you know, again, we've sort of deleted some duplicative language. It's a long day. I'm happy to answer any questions. Sure. Some of these are ripe for conversation.
Great. Thank you. A motion to approve the proposed 2023 qualified allocation plan.
So moved.
And I will second. You want to start off with some questions?
Yeah, I could.
Yep.
So I just want to ask about the difference between the high school graduation rates and the high-performing school districts. What was the number one factor that you would look at in determining what was a high-performing school district?
So we had a link to some metrics on math scores and reading scores, but I think staff would be the first to acknowledge that it was a little hard to sort of parse through that, and it was by, you know, location of the school, and, you know, are we talking about fourth grade or eighth grade, or, you know, I think the guidance we provided wasn't really clear. So the high school graduation rates, I think it's very clear, and we're doing it in terms of, it's not like all or none, it kind of, you know, depending on where they are. And I don't have that list in front of me right now. We've got the points. There are, interestingly enough, there were some communities that you think that would actually be. Middletown is one of them, and they're actually below where the average is. So I think it's kind of it's a fairer metric.
Does it hurt the schools who have, say, made some changes, but they haven't reached that level of graduation? Or too early to tell?
I don't know. I think it's probably too early to tell. And it does actually include charter schools on that list. So it's a pretty comprehensive list. I can send you the link to it so you can see it.
And then just about broadband, I think you answered most of the questions that I had. But so the change was to reflect that the law now requires a minimum contribution from a resident.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That was I was reading that late last night, so that's probably part of the problem. But the section on internet was a little confusing. Okay. Is that, you think that in the average developer IQ, myself in that, is not exceedingly high? So is that language you think most people will be able to swallow and understand?
I think so. And I think actually from a developer's perspective, it's probably more cost effective than what the previous QAP requiring.
Okay.
Because you'll be able to sort of use the existing system. I don't have it right in front of me, but the providers are actually sort of mandated to do this, and it's $30 a month as opposed to, I think under the previous, we were getting costs of $50 to $60 a month from a developer's perspective. So I think actually this will be a welcome change, and you're using existing infrastructure as opposed to having to spend $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 as a capital expense up front to sort of deliver the technology.
Okay, so it's graduated, it seems like the point. So it's like you provide the service, you make sure it's no more than $30 and the resident has to chip in the $10, and then to get the most points, the development pays essentially that $10 on behalf of the residents. That
No. It's graded because there are some income eligible residents with incomes above the federal poverty level, but less than 60%. So they would still provide. The tenants would only have to pay the $10. So it was just a differentiation for certain residents because the law is very specific to people below the federal poverty level, so we wanted to accommodate those residents that were above the federal poverty level. And we can certainly go back and double check that the language makes sense.
Okay. And so we're not, I guess, just from a policy perspective, we're not pushing that the projects provide for free internet service, in essence, as the kind of the highest goal, which is something I believe we talked about last year, that we would move towards that.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways now the federal government has caught up to where we might have been a year ago and said,
right.
You know, something has to be done to make this affordable for all because of the need for education purposes, for work purposes. It's a necessity, not a luxury. And so I think we can adjust our approach a little bit to accommodate that now that there are additional subsidies to be had. It's a good place to be to not have to, you know, bang our heads against the wall about
right.
that.
Do we consider a higher point value if the property provides free internet service?
So you're saying if they pay that $10.
Up $10, or if they come up with some other way
yeah.
to provide for them.
Yeah,
we could threshold of 10 and then they cover the rest for all.
We can certainly consider
back and look at that. I think that's a great suggestion.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and as you know, this will be posted for public comment, so we'll have 30 days, so we can certainly accommodate some changes between now and when we bring it back. So,
our lesson learned from maybe last year was make your comments now.
And we appreciate that.
Right.
You know, being highly involved in what's going on in the broadband space, this would be more helpful in thinking about what that looks like in the future, so that if there is a set standard level that we're encouraging them to do, then it creates a better opportunity for programs that might come down the road later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I actually have a bunch of questions, so I'm going to preface that. So we're not out of here just yet. But I wanted to take a step back and just talk about last year, what we really liked about this year, or last year's QFP, what we really liked about the projects, and if there was some trends we were seeing that maybe we might want to pivot away from. And I mean, three of the five were the 20 deals, 9-4% deals. I think that was pretty significant this year. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think it allowed us to utilize resources and actually get five deals approved this year. So I again, good or bad, or encourage it or not, but I think.
Yeah. I think the geographic diversity that we've seen over, it's been a few years now, 3 or 4 years, the geographic diversity of being able to do developments in suburban and rural areas where often there was no discussion about affordable housing, and if there was discussion, it would be negative.
Yeah.
So I think that the mindset within the communities, and James has talked about this in his community of East Greenwich, I think the mindset has changed a bit. I think developers are more proactive in engaging with community members and town managers and members of the planning and zoning boards and building relationships and pointing to other developments that showcase the work that's done by people that work in this industry. So I think that's a big takeaway from
me. I agree.
In the work we've been able to do. Yeah.
So I don't think we need to change anything. Hopefully we'll continue to get.
I think we're on
geographically
the
diverse.
Path.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The other
right.
thing I would highlight, because it's been really important for us, is that historically speaking, we did not have a great amount of attendance and feedback at some of the QAP meetings we had in years past. I would say the past couple of years, it's been outstanding from both you know, our nonprofit partners and for-profit developers, and a lot of the suggestions that they've brought forth have really informed some of the things we've done. It's been a great exchange, I think, for all of us, and it's been really helpful to have that engagement from the development community so that we, you know, we hear directly, proactively, as you said, rather than after the fact, like, you screwed this up. You know, it's great to...
I'm sure you hear that sometimes.
We, of course, mostly because we didn't give certain people money.
Right,
you know,
right,
works.
Right.
But it's been really good the past couple of QAP seasons, for lack of a better term. We've had a lot of feedback, and it's been really helpful.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that the folks we work with would say that our process is open and transparent. And it wasn't always the message we were hearing, right? It hasn't been that long that we've had a scoring process. We used to rank proposals. So I think that when folks come to Rhode Island, when they come to Rhode Island Housing, they know exactly where they stand. They score their own proposal. There's a back and forth with all of the folks that do this work. And I think it's a fair and open process.
Great.
The only other thing I would add, you know, in terms of things that worked, you know, we all know that, you know, we build housing, right? But we like to think of it's more than sticks and bricks, and we can provide a more holistic environment for folks. The provision, and I think we're up to 4 points now in terms of sort of the service provision, has been great. I think folks were really motivated to think strategically about that, as well as providing permanent supportive housing for folks below 30% AMI. I know Jessica will be, you know, happy to talk about this, but we have now allocated all of our 811 vouchers because borrowers have sort of recognized that it's, you know, both good income, right, but it's also good policy, and the it comes with services. So I think that's been, you know, over the last several years, that's been pretty successful.
I would say for the 20 deals, if you want that to continue, maybe take a look at that scoring just to make sure that there's not a bias towards that.
Yeah.
Because, again, I think it was good. Should we allow to spread the credits? But I don't think we want to necessarily say you got to be a 20 deal if you want to win an award.
Yeah.
Because those are super complex and expensive.
I was going to say, the only people who want that are the lawyers.
Right, right, right.
We have developed a policy, which we've actually circulated among staff, to sort of codify what we think policy should be around these twinning deals.
And I think that's great, and I think we should put that in the QAP. I think we should be kind of, maybe not the entire policy, but just say, if you plan to submit, this is generally how it'll be scored and what you need to do,
yep,
kind of thing. I would also suggest, this applies to the 20, but just also the 4% deals, a minimum score for 4% deals. I think we should be seeing more, and I think that's just good practice. It doesn't have to be like super high, but I think we just want to kick out something that they're just throwing in willy-nilly.
Okay, we'll look at that.
I think we had two elderly deals, two general population deals, and one homeless.
Age-restricted.
Age-restricted, excuse me. Yes, I'm almost there.
I'm going to get you there. You. Across the finish line.
So I think that was good, and I was looking at the con plan, I think it was, and it says that small related households have the biggest need. What is small related household? As opposed to large related, is that?
I don't know, and we don't have any here with us, but we'll go back and we'll look that up.
Okay, it just seems like in small related had the biggest demand,
mm-hmm,
of cost burden households.
Mm-hmm. We know that, I think the statistics is it's either the next 5 or 10 years, there's going to be more people over the age of 65 in the state than under the age of 18, and I think it's an acknowledgement that, you know, households are getting smaller as people age.
Right. There were no three-bedroom units built this time, and they were all studios, one beds and two beds. So I want to make sure that the data.
Yeah.
That is some of the feedback we've gotten from the development community.
Right.
Hey, what about?
Right. And maybe that's because that. Well, the data says we don't really need that much in comparison.
Yeah.
But it should.
And we've talked about, you know, and again, we have an opportunity to go back and sort of tweak this, but, you know, bonus points for larger units. I mean, they are larger units sort of benefit from the way we do our weighted average scoring. So I think that is something we can think about and certainly go back and revisit with some of the developers.
Another item, I think, was that at a couple of deals that were just very expensive, and they had a limited number of affordable units in them. They were almost, you know, they were mixed income. I would almost say that they were, I don't know, really a market rate deal that was trying to fit in a little bit of affordability, as opposed to a lot of affordability that mixed in a little bit of the market rate. So, and maybe this gets to what you're talking about with the mixed income deals, but I was looking at the amount of credits we gave and the amount of subsidy we did per affordable unit. Mm-hmm. And I think on the Parcel 9 and the Frenchtown Road in particular, they were exceedingly high levels of credits per affordable unit and soft dollars per affordable unit. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, and I know you said you wanted to, you're proposing to do away with cost limits. I was actually looking the opposite direction and keep a total cost, total development cost, bump it up given that there's construction cost increases, but I would also ask you to look at looking at a cap on the amount of credits per affordable unit and maybe a general cap on the amount of soft dollars going in per affordable unit. And I just throw out 35,000 in credits per affordable unit, 125,000 and, you know, state of Rhode Island, soft dollars per affordable unit.
That might be a little low, Kevin.
That's fine. Yeah, I've just thrown that out as a mark, but yeah. Just to say the sky's the limit, mm-hmm. I don't think, because these two projects also, they were the most expensive, mm-hmm. and they were the top scoring projects. So I don't think that the financial leveraging sections necessarily result in the most cost-efficient project scoring.
I think one way to address that, and I agree, because some developers are more sophisticated and kind of know how to maximize the scoring. I think one thing that we've talked about is, you know, if there are efficiency ones and twos across the development, proportionately those should be the same between the two. I mean, it's not going to be identical, but, you know, you can't put all the twos in one and all the ones in another. Right, and
when you're doing a nine, and
when you're doing a 20 deal, so that there's, I think that will address some of the issue that you're getting at.
Okay.
And I don't know what the exact, you know, magic is there, but I think it's certainly something we've been thinking about as we're working on this program bulletin.
Okay,
Can you reach out to our colleagues too, Kevin, to see what other folks are doing in terms of. Caps on funding levels. I think the 125.
Okay, that's fine. I pulled up Massachusetts, and I think they're still looking at it. But for instance, they have a total development cap inside of Metro Boston of the highest one they have is 399, and it goes down to 259 a unit. So I don't think our total development cap is all that low right now, but we can certainly bump it up, I think. And it's also NCSHA still recommends having these caps, so we would be going against NCSHA kind of best practices if we did away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I would be very much opposed to doing away with it, but I know
okay.
I want you to have flexibility. From a developer's standpoint, I very much appreciate what you're trying to do, but I just think that doing away with it, we could just end up with some super expensive projects.
Well, we do have, Kevin, we do have scoring that rewards keeping costs down. So it's not a total free-for-all.
I understand that, but what I guess I'm saying, in looking back at these recent projects, the most expensive ones scored the highest. So, again, this is one factor among many,
yep, right.
But it did not serve to produce the greatest number of units at the lowest possible.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it kind of skewed, I think, a little bit too far the other way. Just something to please look at. And the affordability set-asides were relatively low, I think. I'm around, I mean, we developed a lot of units, but they were all, a lot of them were mixed income. And so, which I think is a good, from a general public policy standpoint, but maybe we want to look at incentivizing projects to do more at the 50% AMI or lower, or even the 60% AMI or lower. I just
can take a look at that.
Again.
No, we do incentivize the 30% units. I think
that's going to be. We don't have those, and they all got it because they had the 811 vouchers, but those vouchers aren't there anymore. So.
I mean, there are other strategies to be able to address the lack of 811 units. No, there are local housing authorities. People have been successful,
okay,
particularly with Providence, and certainly Pawtucket and Central Falls, I believe, as well, in negotiating project-based contracts.
We also have,
I think,
oh, I'm sorry.
I think we're going to see one of the highest priorities we have in the state is to help 30% and below.
I think that would be great if we can. And I'm just saying, it seemed like the model was, okay, we'll do these 811 vouchers, and then we'll just go a little bit at 60 and the rest at market. And I'm just thinking maybe we want to pull that back.
Okay. Well, okay.
We do have the HPF ELI subsidy, which is kind of like a sort of an internal operating subsidy funded through the HPF. We could have brought it this month, but we decided to spare everybody. We'll bring it in August. So there is that as well. You know, as you say, it's a balancing act, right? Mm-hmm. So some of the more expensive projects, they were, you know, they're more energy efficient. They're providing a higher level of services.
Right.
You know, they hit some of those, you know, CCD sections. In this case, they were providing free internet. You know, so it's very much a balancing act. I think if we can create some parity within the twinning deals about how they are presented, it will solve some, but maybe not all of your concerns.
Okay. Okay. Great. Let's see. The right of first refusal language, is that, I just want to make sure that's set on some kind of precedent, whether it's other state housing agencies are using that same language or NCSHA.
Yeah.
This language, yes, this language is, rather than reinvent the wheel, actually comes not quite word for word, but a lot of it is similar to what's in Virginia's. We looked at Massachusetts. Corey and I have spent some time with LISC. This is a pretty significant issue, and I think
nationally.
Oh, I know. And I know, you know, Washington State's been sued and some others have been sued. I just want to make sure that we have some cover and what we're doing there.
Yeah. We used Virginia's as a guide when we wrote this.
Okay. And then there's also, I mean, and down there, if you try to do something, don't come back for...
Well, that's kind of, you know, and we've had one qualified contract application.
Yeah.
Once we did the math, they realized it's, you know, it's not going to work.
Right.
Very lucky.
Yeah.
I'm very, very lucky. I know what my colleagues are dealing with in other HFAs across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Let's see. I think that we're going to see maybe some of these 2022 deals, and who knows if maybe 2021 deals even come back for more credits, given construction cost increases and so on. Do you have a sense that that might happen at all?
We are delivering the message to these folks in the who are the received this year's award that you're not getting any more money.
Figure it out.
You figure it out. We've
okay.
given you
okay.
These are the dollars you have to work with. Figure it out.
Okay.
Hopefully we can stick to that.
Right. Okay. Good. I think that's all I got for us.
Do we have a standard way that this information is communicated? You know, because one of the things that I've been doing lately, the governor and the lieutenant governor are having a lot of events where businesses are saying, I'm ready to go to the next level, but I either am a meeby-weeby business or English isn't my first language, or I'm not sure if I'm ready to get into this higher level. How do we communicate this, and do they have a mechanism to ask those questions?
When you say businesses, what do you mean?
Developers.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Are they first-time developers? Or?
Yeah. Often, we're available, and we do one-on-one sit-downs with developers. Ann and her team does that frequently. I don't know that there's actually promotional materials out there about if you want to be a developer, but if you come across folks, certainly
we have
direct them to the agency.
Conversations every week
yeah.
with new developers who have parcels of land, and this is heady stuff, and it's, you know, not for the faint of heart. So we often encourage folks to start with some of our smaller programs. You know, maybe do, you know, 5 or 10 units at a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had a few who, you know, have gone through sort of the training wheels and are now doing larger developments.
Even within the industry, there is, you know, among our nonprofits and
even nonprofits that aren't necessarily working with us right now, there is a need for capacity building, and that's exactly what they did, is develop a program working with LISC to provide classes to folks that are in the development business, even if you're already employed in that industry. So, and I think it's been very successful. We've had, what, over 40 people?
Close to 50 people, yeah, yeah, who signed up. And it's, you know, it's something that is, to me, a priority for our industry as a whole, building a bench of people who know how to do this work. I mean, I don't know what it's like in other states, Kevin, but I know all of us are not getting any younger here in Rhode Island, and it would be great to kind of develop a new generation of folks who can step up and continue the good work.
Like we have here, a new
there
generation.
You go.
Yes.
Yes, this program that Carol's referring to, we started in January. It's about to have its second. It's a three-week program. So the first one, I think, happened in February. The next one's about to happen, and then the third one will be in the fall. And we, you know, we did get a great response. But it's something that I think we can't sit here and say, well, you guys got to get better at things without being part of the solution and without being a good partner and saying, here's where what we think the industry needs and how can we help with that. So this is a great first step, but I think we'll do some more of it in the future.
Even through rent relief, Christine will be presenting a program that will allow some of the smaller nonprofits that are participating with rent relief and are offering, you know, one-on-one services to have access to a training program on how to build their financial capacity, how to build their communications, et cetera. So that will be before you at the board meeting this month. So we're trying to do more of that, as James said, we are. I'm certainly.
Do we have a how to apply, like, workshop?
We usually have a developer's workshop. When we release the RFP, we often have a workshop. This year part of it was focused on the one-stop application and sort of giving folks a comfort level there. I think most of the people who are applying for these dollars, tax credit dollars, are by and large seasoned developers, so they don't need to, you know, they don't need to know how to develop. They need to know what we're looking for in terms of this specific round and kind of what the nuances are, what the changes might be from previous years. You know, where there's an opportunity for that is probably with these more, less experienced developers who are trying to sort of get into affordable housing, right? We get lots of phone calls. Oh, I hear there's all this money for affordable housing. How do I get involved? I have a piece of land, right? And a lot of it is just sort of hooking them up with existing developers who are in the field, right? So you can do some joint venture, or they could sell that piece of property to a developer using our SAFA program, for example, so that they can, develop, that the project gets developed. So it's not always that person needs to do the development. Maybe they need to partner.
And as you probably know, in a bunch of other states, there are the how to apply workshops, and some make them mandatory. Mm-hmm. If you're going to apply, you have to attend this. And others that are, you know, and they literally go. They have the spreadsheet application, and they go step by step. Okay, in this field, we want you to do this, and this. Is that been tried before? You think maybe that?
I don't think at that level.
I don't
know. I don't think we've done it at that level.
It's more big picture. We also encourage, and I don't know if you saw that we actually added the word strongly encourage. We don't have a pre-application process, a formal pre-application, but we encourage folks to come and talk to us. And I can tell you, the seasoned developers, they don't come in once. They come in three times.
Oh, sure.
Let me walk through my scoring with you. Tell me if this is right.
Right.
Like, I mean, so we certainly encourage everybody to do that.
I don't know. Maybe if it's just you set a date, we're going to have a how to apply workshop or something like that. It'll be a little less intimidating or something than setting up a, I don't know. Is that, you think, get to where you're?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it, right? It's a matter of saying, can I even break into it, right?
Yeah.
I used to oversee the PTAC program at Commerce, which was very much geared towards helping small businesses learn how to handle government contracts.
Yeah.
And that's what it was, right? It was a handhold to say, okay, to be honest with you, you're not prepared. But these are the things that you would need to do to come to that space, right? So I think it's just a matter of laying that out for them. So something to consider, because I think folks are at least interested.
And I think we do a lot of that one-on-one.
Yeah.
So rather than having 100 people in an auditorium, I think that one-on-one that's more focused on the specific needs of the individuals that we work with, and it happens all the time. New developers come in through the door, and I like the idea of being able to touch that individual where they are at that point in time, because all of the needs are different and capacity levels are different. So I do like that one-on-one, to the extent we can continue to do that.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. I think that is all for agenda items.
Do you have to vote on this?
You got to vote on this. Oh, sorry. Please, Corey.
Certainly. This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the proposed 2023 Qualified Allocation Plan or PAC as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Great. Thank you. Having no other agenda items, do we go to the
– do you want to do the pipeline?
I think we talked. We heard our pipeline.
I think that's a big pipeline. Yeah. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
This is Corey speaking. All those in favor of adjourning this meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Two affirmative votes. The motion carries.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.